The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Tolerance and universality. I think it's a good way to kind of end this segment of the Philosophy and Mysticism course. There is a lot of reading here, but there's a lot of very important information that's important to go through together. And these are basically collections of things from Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook, who I have shared some of his articles with you. And part of this is from a book called Selected Letters, which I highly recommend for reading. Another one is from another book called Abraham Isaac Cook, some selections from there. So we're going to read it and discuss it. It's a very important topic because, especially with what happened, unfortunately what happened recently, the question is, and I think the concern that people have is fanaticism, right? How do we relate to other factions in the Jewish world? How do we relate to other religions? And so this is relating to that. So we continue. As to alien faiths, over on the left-hand side, I will tell you my opinion. That is not the goal of Israel's light to uproot or destroy them, just as we do not aim for the general destruction of the world and all its nations, but rather their correction and elevation, removal of their dross, and of themselves they will join the source of Israel, where dewdrops of light will flow over them. What is he talking about? Judaism believes that the revelation at Sinai is the most all-embracing revelation of truth. That's what it believes. The mitzvot are particularly the application of that truth to Jews, but that truth, its principles, its perspective on life, is true for all human beings. And how all human beings apply those truths, that's a different issue, whether they would be obligated in all those mitzvot. For instance, even within the Jewish people, we have 613 mitzvot, 613 commandments. We're not all obligated 613 commandments. When we say 613 commandments, that includes commandments that only the king is responsible. For instance, one of the commandments is that the king write a Torah. He write a Sefer Torah, that he has his own Sefer Torah. Right? That's one of 613 mitzvot. I don't have to do that unless I become a king. Many of those mitzvot are related only to Kohanim. Right? Many of those mitzvot are related only to Levites. Many of those mitzvot are related only in certain particular situations. For instance, one of the 613 mitzvot is to get divorced. And that doesn't mean you go get divorced. Gee, I don't want to miss a mitzvah. Right? But it's important to understand that Judaism acknowledges that if it's not working, it's not working, you're going to mitzvah get divorced. So it's important to understand that the number 613 can really be very misleading. But what it does indicate is that how the truth, how the manifestation of God is facilitated through the human vehicle is different based on different roles and different characters in the show. Okay? Different lines, different place that you stand. And that's it. But Judaism is in no way interested in this, certainly in the destruction of the world, the destruction of any other nations. It's not like, well, in the future they'll just be Jews. And that's it. No such thing. Not only that, but it's important to know that according to Judaism, a righteous non-Jew has a portion in the world to come. Righteous non-Jew. My sister was once playing Barbie with her friend Gloria. Gloria was a Catholic, and they were very, very close friends. In fact, my sister would walk Gloria home. Gloria lived up the street from us. And then Gloria said, oh, but Hetty, I must walk you home. So she would walk my sister back home. And then Hetty would say, but I got to walk you home. She would walk Gloria up to her home. And Gloria said, but I couldn't do that. Let me walk you home. And I remember looking at the window of our apartment and seeing my sister go up and down the street like a yo-yo. They were that close. And then finally, after about an hour walking each other home, back and forth, they said, we got to get home. So they would end in the middle and they would, you know, they would part in the midway. So I just want you to understand how close they were. They were really very close friends. And they're playing Barbie, you know. So they're sitting there playing Barbie, Barbie and Ken. One day, Gloria turns over to my sister, and they're both about 10 years old. 10, 11 years old. Glory turns to my sister and she says, Hetty, I feel really sorry for you. So Hetty said, why? She said, because Hetty, you're going to hell. So my sister got shocked, like, what did Barbie do? Did maybe Kurt, Ken, and Barbie do something wrong? I mean, what was, you know, like in the middle of playing Ken and Barbie, why am I going to hell? Right? I mean, Barbie's needs were covered, I don't know. So she said, because you don't believe in Jesus. And my sister answered, well, who is he? Maybe I believe in him. But who is he? You know? And that itself was, oh, now you're really in trouble, man. You really blew it now. What a bizarre idea. Someone's going to hell. You know, someone's going to hell. Because they don't believe in Jesus. You know? I don't understand it. You might remember the story I told you. I think I told you. That I was on a plane. There was this big, huge guy with a Harley Davidson t-shirt. And he told me that he wanted to be a priest. I looked at this guy. No way. You know, I said, yeah, I wanted to be a priest. And he said the reason why he decided not to is because he believes that a man of the cloth should love God the most in the world. And he confessed that he loves motorcycles the most in the world. And so he just felt he couldn't really honestly be a priest. But there's another reason why he decided not to be a priest, besides his incredible love for motorcycles. Is because what bothered him about religion is when he was growing up, he lived in a town that could hardly support one school, and there were three. There was a Catholic school, there was a Protestant school, and there was like a non-religious school. And he remembers the nuns saying to him, now don't you go play with those Protestant boys, because they're going to hell. And he couldn't understand, you know, like, why you can't play football with these guys because they don't believe in exactly our brand and they're going to hell. Alright? Especially if they are going to hell, then we're going to win. So you imagine, why not play with them? It's really a bizarre thing. It's one that people almost anticipate. I bet you Judaism's that way too, because all religions must be that way. Right? They all think they're the only way and everybody else is going to hell if they don't go our way. And that's not true in Judaism. Judaism believes that a righteous non-Jew gets the world to come. A righteous non-Jew is not a person who keeps the mitzvot, but a person who keeps the seven mitzvot. There are seven universal commandments that all human beings should follow. Don't steal. Don't have sexual perversion. Don't do idolatrous practices. These are universal principles that most human beings actually do keep. Right? Most human beings do keep. And you get a world to come. Interestingly enough, also Judaism is not a proselytizing religion, right? And people will think, oh, that's because you're an elitist club. Not true. It's because we believe that you've got to be who you are. And we would not want to encourage someone who's not Jewish to become Jewish, right? We don't encourage it. If you want to be Jewish, and you really want to be Jewish, then we're open to the notion of conversion. But the idea of not converting and proselytizing is not because you're not good enough for us, it's not because we're a closed club, but because we believe you should be who you are. And if you show up to an engineering school, and in their interview they realize, you're not an engineer, you're an artist, then you would hope that they would say, you're not for us, right? You'll be much happier being an artist. And that's very, very critical to understand. And therefore, he's got a verse here, I will take away his blood out of his mouth and his detestable things from between his teeth, and he too shall remain for our God. Now, what is he referring to over there? He's talking about even in idolatry, right, where there's some real ugliness in their practices. We will remove the ugliness, so to speak, the blood from their teeth, and then they will be for God. In other words, the idea of Judaism is that there are other paths in the world, right? And some of these paths do have certain illusions that over time have accumulated around them. And these religions will be refined and they will hook up with the tree of life. But they won't become Jewish necessarily. Right? Nobody said they're going to become Jewish. So imagine, you know, how does Judaism see other religions? You know, when you go to court and they say, you testify and you swear, this is the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth? So if you ever think about it, what do you mean the whole truth? If I said it's the truth, it's the truth. Why do I have to also swear it's the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? What do they mean by that? Right? Well, there's certain things that are true, but they're not the whole truth. Right? You get that with kids all the time. You know, a kid comes in screaming and says, you know, Sammy kicked me! And it's true! And you get really angry. And you go to Sammy saying, you kicked him? He said, well, yeah, because he had a knife in his hand and he tried to kill me. Oh, alright. In other words, truth can be out of context. Okay? But it is truth. Right? Judaism's claim, I'm not expecting you to believe this or accept this, but you do need to know what Judaism is claiming. Judaism claims to be the context of all truths. And that all other teachings will find the truth in themselves within the context of Judaism. And that all of the truths are aspects of this whole truth. And because they're aspects of this whole truth, certain not truths have kind of evolved around them, because when something's taken out of context, then certain misconceptions are built up. Right? It's true that so-and-so kicked me. It's true. But in the context, in the light of the fact that he was trying to attack him, well, so now we see it, and there was that certain misconception becomes resolved. So this is what Judaism believes. It believes that everything, even idolatry, has truth in it. Otherwise it wouldn't exist. Right? It has truth in it. The question is, when this particular true idea is understood to be the whole idea rather than an aspect of a whole idea, then various misconceptions build up around it, are engendered by it. All right? So let's read this for a second a little more. This applies even to idolatry, and therefore even more so to religions whose foundations are partly based on the light of Israel's Torah. And great are the words of the Gaon of Vilna, of blessed memory, one of our teachers. And I hated Esav. That which is secondary in Esav, but that which is primary in him, his head, is treasured with the patriarchs of the world. What does it mean? Esav, who we understand, is the roots of Christianity. In Judaism, Esav, who was the brother of Jacob, and Jacob and Esav are the children of Isaac and Rivka. Esav for the Jewish people, coming out of Esav was Rome. Coming out of Rome is Christianity. Alright? Now it's interesting to know, Esav was a real bad character. Right? I'm not saying that Christianity is a bad character, I'm just talking about Esav right now. Esav was a very bad character. And yet, according to our tradition, right, he was killed. And his head rolled into the Marat Machpelah, the Machpelah cave where Abraham and Isaac and Jacob are buried, and Sarah, Rivka, and Leah are buried. In other words, you know who else is buried in that holy place? The head of Esav. Why? Because he had a good head. Right? He had a good head. The rest of them wasn't so great. But his root was very good, because we see the head as the root of the human being. If you look at a fetus as it grows, the head is the most pronounced. And it's almost as if the whole body is growing out of the head. It's a very big head, if you've seen pictures of fetuses. Because the head is the root. And the body grows out of the head. So at his roots, right, Esav was very good and very holy. But how that progressed out was very problematic. But it's important to understand that we love Esav too, right? When everything will be fixed and everything will be put in its proper perspective, everything's going to be just fine. It's like an example I gave somebody today in my office. There's a famous story about a fellow who came and asked for the secret of life. Want to know? The secret of life. And the master told him, wood, wires, and nails. And he went out totally confused, trying to figure out, gee, wood, wire, and nails. Well, what does that mean? And he just could not crack it. Didn't make sense. And a couple years went by, One day he's sitting on his porch, hears this beautiful music. It was beautiful, so he followed it. And there he saw a fellow playing a guitar. And he just sat there listening to this beautiful guitar music. And all of a sudden he realized wood, wires, and nails. Because with wood, wires, and nails, you could build a guitar. But with wood, wires, and nails, you could build a weapon. It's how you put it together. It's not the ingredients themselves. It's the gestalt, so to speak. How things work together. And therefore, so too in other religions. The Judaism believes that in the Messianic age, there'll be a kind of spiritual reorganization whereby the truths in all these religions, right, that have really given these religions even the possibility to exist, will come forward, flying forward, because they will be put back into the proper organization, and everyone will understand their role and their role in the whole show. Okay? And so therefore, it's important to understand that Jacob says, let's read back, Jacob says about Esav, "And your face is as if I saw the face of God. And the man of truth, Jacob, the man of simplicity, and his words will not be unfilled." Jacob, when he confronted Esav, said, "Your face is like the face of God." He didn't lie. The face of Esav, even the face of Esav, who was considered to be a very evil guy, had a good head, and there's nothing, right? There's no reason to say that he's just simply disposable. He's not disposable. We want Esav to be part of this messianic, you know, we want Esav to be part of this messianic vision. And he will be, because even Esav's face is the face of God. "And therefore," said the man of truth, "the brotherly love of Esav and Jacob, Isaac and Yishmael." Now, Yishmael represents for the Jewish people this root of the Muslims. Okay? So Esav is the root of Christianity, and Yishmael, historically, ends up being Islam. "And Jacob and Esav, and Isaac and Yishmael will rise above all those upheavals, above the evil growing out of the body's profane desires, and will overcome them and turn them into light and everlasting love in kindness." That's our vision. We actually believe that in the future we will all embrace in that brotherly love. Alright? "This broad knowledge, sweetened in the sweetness of the honey of the Torah, of the truth, Kabbalah, must accompany us in all our paths at the end of days to seal the Torah in the palace of the King, the Messiah, by turning bitterness to sweetness and darkness to light." So it would be totally wrong for me just to assume that anything that's not, you know, labeled Jewish is not true. Do you follow this? Very important idea. Imagine if someone had come to me from the, you know, and say to me, "Listen, in the East, there's a tradition," and this is true, I was told this, "in the East there's a tradition to put ashes on your on your eyebrows, and that it gives you wisdom." That is true. Right? That is our tradition. That's what our sages taught us. Do I have the right to say, "Oh, that's so stupid. That couldn't be, because that's not in our tradition. So therefore, if it's not in our tradition, it must mean nothing." No! I don't know. I have no reason to argue that. That's very interesting. If he says to me, "And therefore you as a Jew should do it," that'll argue. Because it doesn't say so in our Bible, to do such things. Right? "And therefore, I'm not going to do it. You do it. You want to do it? Do it. And if this is part of your tradition, maybe." But this, you know, if you meet a religious Jew who feels this need to react to everything that doesn't have the official label Jewish on it, then they really don't understand Judaism. They don't understand really what Judaism is. Okay? It's important to understand that there are other paths, there are other teachers, but Judaism does not compromise in terms of saying that the Torah is the most all-embracing manifestation of truth, and within the context of Torah, all the other religions, their truth will become more clear, and the deceptions or the misconceptions that evolved out of the fact that they were disconnected from this encompassing context will be clarified in the future. And that the role of Mashiach, the role of the Messiah, is to help all the other nations reconnect their paths within the context of the Tree of Life. All right, Saj?
Two questions. One, although you're not saying you don't have the right to say that something else is false, you are saying that everything true has its roots in Judaism.
Yes, but you see, you got to be very careful. And I'll tell you why. Rav Kook explains this another way. We don't believe that Torah is another book on the shelves of the shelf called religions, right? You walk into a bookstore, religions, and there it is, one of the books on the shelf. We don't believe it's one of the books on the shelves. We believe it is the shelf, right? We believe it is the shelf. In other words, if you really understand Torah, you know, it is the universal truth. The fact that you call it Judaism makes it sound very particularistic, but it's not. Judaism believes that it has the universal truth, which all other teachings are really enrooted in, and when that root is severed from its ground, right, misconceptions are bound to evolve. And therefore, if a person was studying, you know, an Eastern religion and found tremendous truth and satisfaction in there, right, well, then if it really is true, then it's definitely going to be in Judaism also. Okay? And people will be surprised that there's, such similarities. Why? Of course, there is a universal truth. The first man and woman had a universal truth. Right? And how that universal truth filtered into the world. Right? It filtered into the world. The question is, what is the authoritative text? Right? Because as time goes on, you know, all kinds of ideas can build up. Judaism's claim is that the principles, the philosophy, the way it understands God and its nature and the purpose of the universe and the way are all connected. Right? Torah is the universal truth. Right? And all other religions are manifestations of Torah. Right? But out of context. Because they're out of context, because they've taken a certain paragraph which is true, that have come to believe that it's the book, well, then it's a mistake. And this is a mistake that you always have to be careful of. When you take a particular idea and begin to think it's the whole idea. Rather, it's a part of a whole idea. Okay? And this is what Judaism believes. That Moses, there was no other prophet like Moses. Moses' prophecy encompassed, it's like the unified field theory of all consciousness. That's what he brought into the world. Right? And therefore, yes, you will find in other religions some beautiful truths. No question. Beautiful truths. Alright? But that's nice, and I'm glad that it's there, because I expect it to be there. But how do I know what in that religion is acceptable and what in that religion is a misconception that has evolved? Judaism claims you have to compare it to Judaism. Right? And that doesn't mean they'll become Jews. They won't be responsible in the 613 mitzvot. Alright? Yeah. Yeah. Hey, I have one more thing I want you to know. There's a very interesting thing that Rav Kook says in another place that you have to take in consideration also. Rav Kook says that there is timing to revelation. There are certain ideas that are not completely true that for the development of the human being, man was allowed to believe. His example, it's a very simple example, simplistic example, but it gives you the point. He says, if man were to prematurely be informed that this world is round, he wouldn't succeed in developing a sense of stability. He needed to believe the world was flat. Because for his evolving consciousness, it was important that he believes that the world is flat, because that would give him a certain sense of, you know, grounding, he'd feel more comfortable with that. And then as he grows older, so to speak, and he's become very secure with the sense of gravity and the sense of that my feet are firmly on the ground, he can find out that the truth is you're upside down right now because the world is round. So too with kids. There's certain things that you don't tell your kids. So you say, okay, let them believe that right now. Because if you were to tell them everything, it would blow them away and they wouldn't be able, they simply wouldn't be able to evolve like a normal human being. This is a very serious idea. Because what it means is that Judaism is saying that there's timing to revelation. And sometimes you're allowed to believe something which isn't exactly true. But right now it's important that you believe that for your development. Alright? So I want you to understand that it could be that it's not like, well then that's terrible if these certain people believe things that are not true. No, maybe in terms of what they need to believe, in terms of their role in the universe right now, that's what they need to believe. But does that mean that I as a Jew need to believe that? So, I'm being very cautious over here because I want you to understand this very carefully. Right? I have no reason to go argue with a Buddhist and start comparing Judaism to Buddhism. Right? I have no reason to do that. I have no obligation to do that. Except if Buddhism transgresses one of the seven noetic laws. One of the seven principles. But anything other than those seven principles, right, in terms of their philosophical way of understanding the world and the nature of being and all that, is really none of my business. Because it's very possible that for who they are and what they have to do spiritually in this world, that's what they should believe.
What about
Well, that was one of the seven mitzvot. You know, if, as I mentioned, if there's something in the religion that transgresses one of the seven mitzvot, then that I have now the right to fix, to, so to speak, point out. For instance, I was on a plane, and I always thought I'd meet my soulmate on a plane. It'd be so easy. You know, there I am with my lucky ticket, and I gotta sit down, and there she is. By the end of this trip, I'm gonna be engaged, and life will be just so flying, okay? So I always thought, yeah, right, I'm gonna have that lucky ticket. Every time they give me my seat number, I said, who's beside me? You know, who am I gonna spend the next 3 hours with? Okay, so I'm walking down the aisle, you know, generally I get this real big fat guy with a cigar, but one time, I'm traveling, and one time I turn over, and there is this very attractive woman, right, and I look at my ticket, and I say, and she looks religious, you know, she's dressed, you know, dressed modestly, and I say, ah, this is going to be my soulmate, you know, at least my soulmate, right, so I sit down, we start to talk. And she asked me what I'm doing, and pretty quickly I started to realize that I don't even think she's Jewish. not to even think she's religious. She was religious, but she wasn't Jewish. She was a born-again Christian. Yeah? So at that point I thought to myself, gee, is there anything we're going to talk about now? I mean, what's going to be the direction of our conversation? So I thought, you know what? I'm going to tell her about the seven noetic laws, right? The seven universal principles. And I told her, I said, did you ever hear the seven commandments? She said, you mean the ten? I said, no. The seven. She said, I never heard of the seven. Oh, yeah, let me tell you about the seven. So I start telling her about the seven. And one of the seven is to not practice idolatry. And she said, oh, gee, I don't practice idolatry. I said, well, I'm glad you say that, because, you know, there are some Christians that believe that Jesus is God. And she looks to me and she says, well, I believe that. I said, that's a problem. She says, why is that a problem? I mean, I believe he's God. I said, no, that's called idolatry. Because you are putting God in a corporal form and you don't do that. And she said, well, why not? And I said, well, listen, I want you to know that if you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, that's okay. I am too. And so are you. We all are. You know, but if you like that, just talk about him in that way more than other people, you can do that. If you believe that he's the Messiah and that he's coming back, you can do that. Right? There's nothing wrong with someone believing that Jesus is Messiah. You know, really? You know, for a non-Jew to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, there's nothing wrong with that. Right? Isn't that idolatry to believe that someone was the Messiah? You want to believe that? Believe that. Right? If you think that when you pray and you mention his name, that's going to get you in, you're going to mention his name. We do it too. When we say the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, why do we say that? It's like, you know, it's in Israel, it's something called protexia. You know, or in Yiddish they call it schlep. You know, like, you know, I know so-and-so. And that gives me a certain credibility. If you feel that that will give you a certain credibility and, you know, mention that you, you know, you vote Jesus, fine. It's okay. But you can't pray to him. Right? You cannot think he's God. Boy, she didn't know what she was in for the next 3 hours, you know, like flying with this nut beside her. And but see, that's the important thing. Martin Buber once said something very interesting. He said, you know, really, what's the difference between the Jews and the Christians? Or what's one of the major differences? The Jews believe that the Messiah has not yet come. The Christians believe that the Messiah has come and he's coming back. Right? He said, my suggestion is we all wait. Why don't we just wait? Why are we arguing over this thing? We'll wait. When the Messiah comes, we'll ask him, were you here before? Right? And then Buber said, and quite frankly, if Messiah asks me my opinion, which I don't think he will, but if Messiah asks Martin Buber's opinion, Martin Buber said, if he asks me my opinion, I will suggest that his answer be, gee, I don't remember. I don't know. I don't remember if I was here before. And what is this all about? So you have to understand that certain things are just not important to argue about, right? Because maybe you should believe that. I don't know. The question is, what does it mean in a bigger way? So Judaism believes, you know, I know there are certain rabbis like Rabbi Yaakov Emden who believes that Christianity is a very good religion for the Gentile world. That it was a very good religion for the Gentile world. Now, there are a lot of rabbis who disagreed with that. And Rabbi Yaakov Emden was no pushover either. He was a very, very respected rabbi. But he's under the impression that Christianity is a good alternative to Gentiles. It's an authentic religion, a path for Gentiles. And he is not of the opinion that Jesus is idolatry. Okay? Because it's a question. It's not so simple. It really is a question. And that's interesting. He's of the opinion that Paul, right, who's really the founder of Christianity, Jesus is not the founder of Christianity. Okay? It's a big mistake. Because Jesus was an Orthodox Jew. And you should know something. He was a fanatical Orthodox Jew. He would not even heal non-Jews. Just forbidden. I mean, what kind of attitude is that? So when they talk about Jesus having these healing powers, right, it's known that he would not heal non-Jews. Only Jews. Which is really when you say, what? So he was a strong religious Jew. Now, we have certain problems with him, and that's, you know, I'm not going to go into this whole discussion about Christianity right now. But it's important to understand that who really brought Christianity to the public. It was Paul, a number of hundred years after Jesus even died. Right? It's very questionable how successful Jesus was during his time. Okay? But it's hundreds of years later that Paul of Tarsus had this revelation and then began to market Christianity. Now, according to our tradition, Paul was a student of Rabbi Gamliel II, which is very serious. Rabbi Gamliel II is one of the rabbis from the Talmud, and he was one of his disciples. One of the theories on Paul is, I'm not saying everybody agrees to this, but it's interesting to know that there is such a theory, that Paul intentionally decided to create a religion for the non-Jewish world. Right? And that is what he intended to do. He had no intentions of trying to convert Jews. He was trying to create a religion for the non-Jewish world. Right? And Yaakov Emden is of the opinion that it was a good idea to do. Now, I'm not saying there weren't some terrible things that were done in the name of Christianity against the Jews. That's later on. The question is, did Paul have any intention of any of that? And certainly some were of the opinion that definitely not. So, what am I saying? There are different ways. But Judaism sees itself as the context. And that all these different ways could be valid for those people. And even the misconceptions of those ways, as long as they are somehow severed from the context called Torah, may even be important in terms of the role they play in the universe. Alright? But, in the end, when the Mashiach comes, everything will be clarified, all will be understood and put together, but that doesn't mean that everyone's going to become Jewish. No, no. That everyone will see how they all fit together in revealing this truth of God. And that there are times in your life where you needed to believe something, even though it wasn't absolutely correct, But for your development right now, you need to believe that. Right? For instance, I think kids need to believe that their parents are the greatest in the world. At a certain stage in their development, that's what they need to believe. As they grow older, they realize that they're not the greatest in the world. They're humans like any other human beings. Right? But in certain places, in certain roles, while a child's growing up, that's really what the child needed to believe. So it's important to know that sometimes there are things you need to believe. Right? Even though right now, even though in the future we'll see that it wasn't completely so. Right? It's not like the world isn't flat. It's flat where I'm standing. Right? But as I get a greater view of it, it's really round. Right? It's made of all these segments of flat that comes round. So it's important to understand that certain things are concealed, which give rise to a misunderstanding, but that doesn't mean that the idea in its essence isn't true, and nor does it mean that the misunderstanding isn't useful and productive. And maybe in light of this development, that's what these people have to believe in terms of where they're at. As long, the bottom line is the seven universal laws. That's the bottom line. All right. Anything beyond that, I don't know. I really don't know. Okay? Yeah.
When you're talking about the four being about all embracing truth, so is it like this? Is it that Torah is true and we just happen to have it? Not that we have it and so therefore it's true. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, certainly not because we have it, therefore it's true. Although that's how generally people think anyways. Right? Right? No. 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 But the question that needs to be resolved is, why did God reveal himself to the Jewish people? Why did God entrust the Jews with this truth? Okay? Why? And that's a long story. I'm not going to deal with that today. But that's an important question. You know? But it's important to understand that the Jews' role in the universe is a universal role. It's not like, we've got our little thing, and we're all going to heaven, and they're all going to hell, and that's the way it goes. You know, and everyone else in the world somehow lost out. Too bad they weren't chosen like us. That is wrong. That is very, very wrong. Because the Jewish people have a universal responsibility. Okay? A universal responsibility, and ultimately our vision of the Mashiach is coming for the world, the whole world. Okay? And that clarification of the various paths and how they all interface and how they all ultimately are all enrooted in this one tree of life, right, will be clarified in the future. That is our claim. Again, so why should I believe this claim? I'm not saying you should believe this claim. I'm saying that you should understand that that is what Judaism says, and it's such a serious claim that one, I think, would benefit by exploring that claim, because it's not just a little thing, you know, it's serious. Let's go to this second paragraph here. The habit of leaving one study for another, and nevertheless to be saved from the curse of there is no peace for him that went in and out, is particularly appropriate today. The root cause of unrest in the world and in Judaism is nothing but the abundance of lights which shine and flow simultaneously. The problem is, there's a huge amount of light of revelation actually pouring into the world today. Okay? And you can't find the truth in only one little place. Okay? There's a tremendous amount coming through in sciences. Okay? Let me give you an example. There's a Zohar that says that in the late 1900s, the upper gates of wisdom will open up and the lower gates of wisdom will open up. And our access to the upper gates will be through the lower gates. That's what the Zohar says. But what does it mean? The Vilna Gaon, who is one of our great sages, explains. The lower gates are all the sciences. Physics, math, biology, psychology. And the upper gates is Kabbalah. And he said that through science, we will be able to understand our Kabbalah. And it's happening today. It's unbelievable. I have friends who are experts in science and Kabbalah and are showing how the two, in fact, work together. It's really quite remarkable. And there'll be some books coming out soon about that kind of thing. So what does that mean? There's truth in a lot of places. And the revelation goes on. Right? The revelation goes on. But the question is, what's the bottom line? How do I know I haven't somehow overstepped my boundaries? All right? Well, Judaism says if you're a Jew, this is your role, this is what you play. And everybody else, I don't know. I just don't know. I don't know. But is there a lot of validity there? In some places there's a lot of validity, in some places less validity. But that there is validity, yes. Because if there wasn't, it simply wouldn't exist. Right? Nothing could exist unless it has a spark of godliness to it. It just simply wouldn't exist. Right? The question is, how does it fit into the whole story?
So, given what you're saying now and what we were saying earlier about the seven Noahide laws, how come you felt that we could judge religions by our truth?
Because we don't see the seven laws as our truth. We see the seven laws going back all the way to Noah, who is the father of all people. And we claim that this is being known, that these are basic moral principles that any human being would know, you know?
But people throughout time have approved multiple gods and used idolatry and stuff like that.
Also, people make mistakes. You know? Certain traditions don't make it to certain places. I mean, the Rambam, who was a great Torah sage, he never got the tradition of Kabbalah. Ah, but if Judaism had Kabbalah, how could the Rambam not know it? Didn't get it. He didn't know Kabbalah, the Rambam. You know? He had just did not plug into that. So as the nations were split up, after the Tower of Babel, and you have the development of a world in different nations, different aspects of the sparks of truth are going out here and there and there and here, you know? Question is, who was the guardian of the authoritative text, right, that people should go back to and take a look at in the end, or, you know, whatever, whenever that happens? Judaism claims that the Jews, people, that was their role in the universe, right? To be the guardians of the Torah. And that they have this connection going back all the way to Seth, who is the son, you know, it's going all the way back to Seth, who was the son of the first man. How could the chain be broken in certain communities? It happens in a lot of other things, so why shouldn't it happen in terms of these truths too?
You said that the Zohar says the gates of wisdom will open up in the 1900s?
Late 1900s.
CE.
Well, it doesn't use that word. It gives a Hebrew date, but the Hebrew date turns out to be, I can't remember, it was like 1885 or something. And I can't remember, I have it in my room. But it's talking about the explosion of sciences that happened in the late 1900s. You know, and it's amazing, you know, how scientific models help understand the Kabbalah. You finally say, wow, that's what he was talking about. You know? So the point is that the revelation goes on, and everything in the world is part of this whole story in different ways. But Judaism definitely says that there is a distinction between the Torah and these other paths. But not that these paths don't have validity. They do have validity, but being separate from the Torah over history, there are certain misconceptions that have evolved around them. Let's go to the next column where it says, I will tell you, sir, a most important principle. The most enlightening outlook on the subject of religious beliefs and views, as with all lofty matters, involves leaving the narrow sphere where one finds conflicting opinions that are hostile towards each other or completely negate each other, and to reach the lofty peak from which the roots of all opinions can be seen. That's what you've got to do. You have to be able to see how all the opposites and conflicting opinions are actually rooted in a oneness. And I'll explain that in a second. For all opinions rise to one place, and all differentiated only due to different conditions of ways in life and states of soul. And the mature researcher, using common sense joined with clear and correct emotions, know how to appreciate the value of everything and how to integrate all the opinions in such a way that each one completes what is lacking. Right now I'm only seeing three dimensions. And from the three-dimensional perspective, there are about 20 different separate people in this room. Right? What if I gave you glasses that took you into the fourth or the fifth or the sixth dimension, and you discovered that we're really all one? Right? We're really all one. And that we really all have red hair. Wouldn't that be ecstasy? Wouldn't that be ecstasy? And it's true. Okay. So you have something to look forward to. Alright. If you look down at the bottom, there's a little footnote, or number 3. It says, according to Rav Kook, there are two types of tolerance regarding ideas. The first, which he supports, a recognition that all ideas have a divine source and therefore must have some value. The second, which he condemns, is an apathetic tolerance of any idea and a disrespect for the importance of divine truth. What's the difference? When you say tolerance, what do you really mean? If tolerance means that I believe every idea has in some way its roots in divinity and therefore value, but that doesn't mean that it's completely correct, but it means that there's value to the idea and one must be very critical in understanding it, then that's proper tolerance. But if tolerance means it doesn't really matter, divine truth, not divine truth, anything goes, that's not real tolerance. That's not what we should be saying. So when you get to fanaticism, what is a fanatic? A fanatic is a person who accepts and is committed to one idea at the expense of another idea, which is also true. Okay? What do I mean by that? I'm committed to Shabbat. And I love Shabbat. And I see a person driving through my community in their car on Shabbat. And so I pick up a rock and throw it at their car. Right? That's a fanatic. Why? Because my love for Shabbat, I'm sacrificing another value, which is, first of all, you don't break someone else's property. That's damages. It's forbidden to break somebody's property. Right? Second of all, I should love Jews. And what I just did is desecrated God's name. What I just did is transgress two very important principles in Judaism at the cost of another principle. That's a fanatic. A person who's committed to what they believe in, that's not a fanatic. That's a person who's committed and is consistent. But fanaticism is when I take a particular idea and make it into the whole idea. Like Shabbos is the only and ultimate idea and all other values are no longer important. Right? That's already, you know, that's already on the level of fanaticism. I once had a group of Israelites. We used to go down to the Kotel Friday night to do even Kabbalat Shabbat. That was before we had this place. And we would go and do Kabbalat Shabbat at the Kotel. Now I knew that there are certain people at the Kotel who are of the opinion that they don't want to hear women singing. Right? There are different opinions in halacha about that. But I know there's some people that that's the way they see things. Okay, fine. So I try to be very respectful. And I try to be very sure that the group would be singing, but during the hustle and bustle at the Kotel, but not when things quiet down and we would stick out. Well, one Shabbat it got very late, and we went down there, and we were a bit conspicuous. And nearing the end of our service, we were very conspicuous. I had walked away for a moment to speak to somebody, and the group at the end of the prayer broke into a spontaneous song of Ein Kelo Kenu, right? And I knew that this is not going to go well over down here. It's so quiet that we're going to really stick out. Before I had a chance to go back to the group, some fellow, we were at the back, right? We were at the back where everybody kind of stands, closer to where this tourist stands. A guy at the front, next to the wall, picks up a metal chair and throws it at the group. Or at me. I think it was at me. Because he saw I was the leader of the group. And it was very kind of him. I was tired. I didn't want to sit down. I tell you, the desecration. First of all these tourists watch a person who in their eyes is a religious Jew because he's wearing a long black coat and he's got peyote and he's got a kippah on his head. All those tourists saw it. And all the students who I had spent so much time trying to help alleviate so much baggage and hatred against Judaism, and he just fed right into what they expect happens when you accept the Torah lifestyle. All right? That's a fanatic. Right? It's a fanatic. What? Because you particularly are of the halachic opinion that women can't sing? First of all, there are other opinions in halacha. Right? Other opinions in halacha about that. Second of all, even if there weren't any opinions about it, and even if you are right, that they should be singing, right? But does your wrong make it right? By taking a chair and throwing it at somebody? Does that make sense? It's wrong. That's coming from fanaticism. That you have sacrificed something in Judaism for something else in Judaism, when you're supposed to be balanced and be able to see how it all works together. Tolerance is appreciating that there are differences of opinions. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, which was the son of Rav Isaac Cook, he wrote a beautiful letter which was being handed out during the funeral. Somebody might have handed you a Hebrew letter. This was a letter written by Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, who passed away about 10 years ago. And it was a letter that he wrote during the early pioneering days of the early Zionists. Now, it's important to know that the early Zionists were not very religious. In fact, many of them were anti-religious, like really anti-religious. And there's some real horrible stories about, for instance, when the Taimanim came, the Yemenite Jews came to Israel, how some of these early Zionists had intentionally cut their peyot and sent them off to non-religious kibbutzim to undermine religious Judaism from the Yemenite people. And there's a lot of anger about that till today. So there's some real crimes that were committed during those early times. Nonetheless, even though many of those early Zionist pioneers were heretical, that doesn't mean they don't have a truth also. There's something truthful about what they were doing. They understood the meaning of the land of Israel, and that is a basic Jewish thing. There's other things they did not understand, but what they did understand must be recognized and appreciated. So Rav Cook wrote during this time where there was a lot of struggle, and it's important because it's happening today also. Nobody has the whole truth. Not one party has the whole truth. And when you think you do, you're in trouble. Torah believes it has the whole truth, but what is the whole truth? It includes all the other truths. Right? That's when you have the whole truth. When your truth includes all the other truths. When your opinion can even include your opponent's opinion, then you'll have the whole truth. But in the meantime, it's not true. You won't reach that level so quickly. But what you have to know is nobody has cornered the market on truth in this political world. And when a person goes and kills the prime minister of Israel thinking that he is absolutely wrong, no, there's a lot of right in what he was trying to do. And there was a lot of wrong in what he was trying to do. And there was a lot of right in what the right was trying to do. And there's a lot of wrong in what the right was, you know. And everybody's saying that now you guys are responsible. It's all the right wing's fault that this happened. Right? And we, again, are the only ones that are right. No such thing. No such thing. And therefore, tolerance is appreciating that there is validity in other ideas. There is validity in other ideas. And there is validity in other religions. Not everything they say is valid. But that doesn't mean that there isn't things that are valid. And just because it doesn't have the official title Jewish doesn't mean it's not valid. That's a very important teaching. All right, very, very important teaching. Okay. These are some insights of Rev Cook. It is proper to hate a corrupt person only for his defects. But insofar as he is endowed with a divine image, it is in order to love him. We must also realize that the precious dimensions of his worth is a more authentic expression of his nature than the lower characteristics that developed in him through circumstances. It is for this reason the Talmud limits the permission to attack the Nama Aretz, a coarse person, to his back, but not to his front, the open aspect of his life that is illumined by divine light. When Judaism says, and there are times where you're supposed to hate somebody, you never hate them. You hate their defects. The problem that happened was, people came to hate Rabin. You don't hate Rabin. You hate Rabin's ideas. But he and his ideas are not the same. Right? And his ideas could change. They have changed. And they may change again. So you don't hate the person, you can hate their ideas, but you cannot you do not hate the person. You can hate their defects, but you don't hate them. And you should know that their precious, authentic side is more primary than these defects. Okay? And that's a basic idea. Let's look at 10. Much effort is needed to broaden the love for people to proper level, to the proper level, at which it must pervade life to its fullest depth. This must be done in opposition to the superficial view, which suggests itself initially on the basis of inadequate study of the Torah and of covenantal morality, and where it seems as though there is a contradiction to such love, or at least indifference. Rav Kook says that we need to love all human beings. It's not Rav Kook saying it, right? Ahavta l'ra'echa kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself, according to the Ari, who was one of the great leaders of Kabbalah. He explains it's all human beings. All human beings. You have to love all human beings. He also explains that in order to attain divine inspiration, which is a certain level of, it's a very low, but it is a level of prophetic knowing, you need to be able to love all human beings. It's a criteria. Right? You know all the Torah. You know, you're all the mitzvot. If you don't love all human beings, you will not succeed in getting this level of prophecy called divine inspiration. So it's important to understand this. The highest level of people, the highest level of love for people is the love due the individual person. It must embrace every single individual, regardless of differences in views on religion, or differences of race, or climate. It is essential to understand the mentalities of different nations and groupings, to study their characteristics and lifestyles, in order to know how to base our human love on foundations that will readily translate themselves into action. It's an amazing thing. Here's a rabbi with a long white beard, who lived in Meir Shearim, wore one of those fur hats, just, you know, it's important to know. Right? It's based on Torah. He's teaching us that you have to love all peoples, and that must be translated into action, and the way they do that is by understanding who they are. You have to know a little bit about them. How can you love someone if you don't know something about them? And he says, loving them means to wish for their better interest and to help them. It is only a person which is rich in love for people and a love for each individual person who can reach the love for his own nation in its noblest dimension, spirituality and practicality. Whew. He's saying you can't even really love the Jewish people unless you are interested in loving all people. Why? Doesn't make any sense. I think the opposite. There's a separation. No, he's saying, no, if you really want to love your people, you have to have a universal love in you. Why? Because the meaning of the Jewish people is only insofar as they serve universal man. They serve universal man. If you couldn't care less about universal man, then you would have no reason to love the Jewish people. Because the Jewish people's role is of a universal nature. Right? When we pray for Mashiach, we pray for the Mashiach for the whole world. When we pray for peace, we're talking about peace for the whole world. When we build the base of Mikdash, it will be ultimately a house of prayer for all peoples. Right? Without asking them to convert in order to be part of that prayer. All right? And I had a wonderful fellow by the name of, James Tabor. He's a professor in Charlotte. He's got his PhD in Second Temple period, Christianity in Second Temple period. This man is now one of the leaders of the Noetic movement, which is a new movement in America, which I really predict in the next 30 years it's going to be all over America. These are Christians who have given up Christianity and have embraced the seven Noetic laws and see the Jewish people as the spiritual leaders for the world. Right? And James Tabor told me that in the Second Temple period it is known that in the synagogue, in the Jewish synagogue, there is a place for the men, there is a place for the women, you know, there was a machitza, and there's a place for Jews, and there's a place for non-Jews. Non-Jews used to come to shul. And there was a special place also. And we prayed together, but we didn't think that we're one and the same. Because then, God forbid, we don't want to intermarry, but we do want to invite you to our prayers. It's not really our prayers. We want to pray together. It was really quite a remarkable scene, he said. Right? And they were called the Yirei Hashem, he told me. They were called the fearers of God. They were not Jews. They had no intentions of converting. No one was encouraging them to convert. but they had a place in the synagogue. Right? They had a place in the synagogue and were welcomed in the synagogue without making, losing sight of, yet you're not Jewish and I am Jewish, and we need to also maintain a healthy sense of distinction so that we don't intermarry. And that's very interesting to understand that during the Second Temple period, what synagogue do you know that invites non-Jews and has a special area for the non-Jewish people? No such thing today. But there was, according to him, in the Second Temple period. Okay. The narrow-mindedness that leads one to view whatever is outside a particular nation, even what is outside the Jewish people, as ugly and defiling, is a phase of the frightful darkness that undermines altogether every effort to reach that state of spiritual development whose dawn is awaited by every sensitive spirit. See, there's a problem. It's so narrow to think, well, you know, it's like someone say to me, well, is it okay for me to do yoga? Right? As far as I know, yoga has certain exercises, right? It has a spiritual impact. But for the person to have the right to say, I don't know any sage in the Talmud that ever did yoga, so forget it. It's worthless. Why? I asked my Rebbe. My Rebbe was born and raised in Mea Shearim, right? And I asked him, and he said, any practice that brings you closer to God is valid, as long as it does not conflict with any halakha, any Jewish law, or certainly any of the principles. He says it's okay. I asked him about this. So, is there value to it? There's value to it. Can it enhance our spiritual lives? Great. Fine. But just because it wasn't founded by a Jew, or it's not technically part of the Torah, if it helps you come close to God, it is Torah. Right? The fact that it's not literally found in the Torah, that's a narrow understanding of what Torah is. Torah is the path to come close to God. Question is, what do you mean by God? No. And that's something that needs further clarification. Look at number 11. One must discipline himself to the love of people, especially the love of the nobles among them, the sages, the poets, the artists, the communal leaders. The artists, the poets, you should love them? Yeah, they have a special place in your heart. It is necessary to recognize the light of the good in the best of people. For through them the light of God is diffused in the world. Whether they recognize the significance of their mission or not, doesn't matter. You should love them. In other words, there are certain people who have a certain pivotal position in the global village. They're doing something for all the people, and therefore they deserve a certain special concern. Because they're doing something for all people. Number 5. The love for people must be alive in heart and soul. A love for all people, love for all nations, expressing itself in a desire for their spiritual material advancement. Hatred may direct itself only towards the evil and the filth in the world. One cannot reach the exalted position of being able to recite the verse from the morning prayer, praise the Lord, evoke His name, declare His work among the nations, without experiencing the deep inner love stirring in one's solicitousness for all nations, to improve their material state, to promote their happiness. This disposition qualifies the Jewish people to experience the spirit of Mashiach. When will the Jewish people experience the spirit of Mashiach? He says, when we love all peoples. We should love all people. That doesn't mean we should become all people, because that's not love. If I have to become you to love you, then that's not love. That's not love. We should be able to maintain our distinctions, our separate cultures, our separate customs, and still have a lot of love for each other. And one last thing. Whenever in our classic tradition we encounter allusions to hatred, clearly the reference is to the phenomenon of evil, which is disrupted by force the unity of many nations at the present time. And certainly in ancient times when the world was in a much lower moral state. But we must realize that the life process, its inherent light and holiness, never leaves the divine image with which each person and each nation has been endowed. And that's it. Right? When we have things in Torah, when it says in the Shemona Esrei, you know, cast down our enemies, every Jew knows. That's not referring to the people, it's referring to their enemy quality. But not people. We want people to be able to change. We believe people will change. All right? And let me leave you with one last little story. It's really a midrash. You know, in Sdom, there was the nephew of Avraham. His name was Lot. And Sdom was destroyed. And Lot and his two daughters were saved. And they're in a mountainous area. And from their perspective, they thought the whole world was destroyed. Because what do they know? They didn't think it was just Sdom. They thought the whole world was destroyed. Well, you know, there was a flood where the whole world was destroyed. Well, now it's fire. The whole world was destroyed. And it's just Dad and we two sisters. So one sister said, let's lie with our father and propagate mankind. Right? Because we are obviously the new Noah. Right? The world will be replenished through us. So, you know, even though this is incest, but we're the, you know, start the world up again. The other sister said, no way. Four. Look how many times human beings have blown it. I mean, what's the purpose of regenerating a world that will only destroy itself once again? The other sister said, no, I believe in mankind. I believe it's going to happen. I believe someday we're going to get our act together. And there will be peace, and there will be love, and there will be holiness. Okay, well, they got their father drunk. And one sister lay with her father and was impregnated. And the other sister lay with her father. She was impregnated. And one called her son Moav, which means from my father. I mean, she was not embarrassed. Moav, from my father. Av is father. And the other one called the son Amo, which is from my friend. You know, it's a little more, you know, concealing. It was from her father. Well, do you know who Moav is? Out of Moav came a woman named Ruth. And Ruth, who was not Jewish, she was a Moabite, she converts, she becomes Jewish, and her grandson is King David, and out of King David comes Mashiach, and one asks, Mashiach? The Messiah, if you look at his family tree, goes back to this incestuous moment between the daughters of Lot and Lot, and especially the one that was so proud of her act, right? It's so different than Christianity. For Christianity to be Messiah, immaculate birth. She was a virgin. You know? But Judaism is saying that the roots of our Mashiach is some real heavy-duty, muddy-looking stuff. I mean, imagine someone tries to fix you up with Mashiach. Right? And you say, you know, we got this nice guy. We think he's got a future. Yeah. Tell me about the family. I was afraid you're going to ask that. Well, you know, like, well, I mean, where's his ancestry coming from? Well, his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother was a guy. Right? She wasn't Jewish. Oh, but she converted. Oh, okay. But where's she coming from? Well, she's coming from Moav. Oh, wait, Moav. Isn't that incestuous relationship with Lot? I don't want to go out with him. But he's Mashiach. Oh, yeah, right. You know? Why? Why is it the Mashiach comes into the world through this very strange way? What is it about this daughter of Moav that gave her the merit to initiate a messianic process? She believed in human beings. She believed in human beings. Her sister said, "Ah, we're going to blow it again." She said, "We'll blow it, we'll blow it. But one day we'll get it right. And there will be, and we will get it together. And it will be beautiful." And this is one of the major teachings of Judaism. Judaism, with all its horrific, tragic events throughout its history, has miraculously shown tremendous optimism, tremendous belief in human beings, tremendous belief in human beings. After the Holocaust, I would expect that most Jews would be the most hateful of all peoples towards all people. And yet it's not true. You know, Jews are, in general, very universalistic. In general. My experience in teaching is that whenever I say anything that even in the slightest way sounds like a critique of another philosophy or another religion, boy, do I get dumped on. Jews react. You said that about Buddhism. You said that about Christianity. Right? It's unbelievable. Because Jews are universalistic in their soul. They are universalistic in their soul. Because their particular identity has meaning for the whole world. Right? And that's how we see it. That Abraham accepted the covenant on behalf of the world, and that the world is very interested in the Jews being who they are, because when the Jews are who they are, then that's part of everyone else also being who they are. And we can differ, but we can still be one.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.